You're listening to a KNKX News special report. I'm Ed Ronco. Tonight, KNKX connects to Centralia and Chehalis. We visited the Twin Cities in Lewis County for a recent broadcast of All Things Considered, and we're going to bring you the show tonight in three segments: land, people, and community. First, land. Washington State's only coal-fired power plant is in Centralia, but its days are numbered. The coal mines that once fed it were closed in 2006, taking several hundred high-paying jobs with them. And under an agreement with the state, the plant's two coal power stacks will be shut down or converted to burning natural gas. That will happen in 2020 and 2025, respectively. But the plant could also be a leader in clean power. TransAlta, the company that owns the land, has plans to cover 900 acres of it with solar panels. It would create the state's largest solar farm, big enough to power about 14,000 homes. KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe has been in the field learning about this and got a tour of the site.
Well, our guide was Bob Gunther, who currently does government relations for the IBEW, that's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and it's the union that he was part of for the 34 years that he worked at the TransAlta plant in Centralia. So I asked him for a tour, and our first stop was a hill up above the plant. It really seems like this plant and the steam coming out of it is part of the landscape of Centralia, almost like the Space Needle is for Seattle. Huh. So I asked him about that.
Having worked at that plant for many years, I know if they're online. I know if both units are online. And when you see that steam plume from the freeway, you know that there's money going into our economy and supporting our grid. And TransAlta has been very, very good in the community as far as helping the community, giving back to the community, and giving back to our economy.
Giving back to the community. What does he mean there?
Well, TransAlta has been the largest emitter of greenhouse gas pollution, of air pollution in the state. And so there's an agreement that the plant has to shut down, as we mentioned. And as part of that agreement, TransAlta is giving $55 million back to the community. Bob Gunther is part of a coal transition board. This is nine people who are deciding kind of how this money will be spent. And he mentioned that part of that agreement also said that the company needed to be able to sell a certain amount of power in state by a certain deadline. We missed the deadline. And nonetheless, TransAlta, this Canadian company, decided that they would release this $55 million.
So this new solar installation, you really wanted to see, what it would look like. He took you to the actual place where this is going to happen. What did that look like?
Well, as close as we could get. Yeah. We were actually on the side of a road looking out with the belching stacks of the power plant on our left. And here he is showing it to me.
Looking at the southern exposure of the hillsides here, this is where the solar site could be put. And actually, the solar farm would go on the mine property itself. This all what we're looking at here has been mined.
So, Bellamy, I think about the former site of a mine, and I think of a kind of a big hole in the ground, and it's hard for me to envision how solar panels might work there. Is it sunken down, or does it look just like a regular field?
It looks like just a rolling hillside. It really has been filled back in, and it's grown over with low grass and brush in some areas. And then to the southeast of that, there are separate plans for a wind farm to be put in.
It's a big change coming there. It's fascinating to listen to. And I'm wondering, though, if you know, it kind of signals the end of the era, and that might be bittersweet for many people in the region.
Bob Gunther, in his role as kind of a lobbyist and a deal maker, you know, really has to work with all kinds of people. And so I asked him, you know, what do your Republican colleagues say about this transition? And bear with me here because a big truck drove by on the road where we were standing as he answered this, but I really wanted you to be able to hear it.
Well, I'm sure that a lot of them say, why? We don't need to shut this plant down. It's the cleanest coal plant in the United States, and it's affecting our economy. But I don't think we have an option in the future here, and we need to be on the cutting edge, on the right side of the paradigm shift. So when you say, well, we got right and left, yes, we have a lot. We don't have a Democrat in the county seat. We don't have a Democrat in the legislature. But that doesn't mean that I don't have a lot of good Republican friends. But what I tell them many times, you better think about that bald eagle flying around. That bald eagle has to have a left wing and has to have a right wing in order to fly.
You know, Bellamy, I think I heard in his voice that he cares pretty deeply about all of this.
I asked him at another point during our interview why he does this. And he basically said he doesn't need this work in his retirement, but it's something he feels called to do because he really deeply cares about this amazing transition into a clean energy economy. And even though his livelihood was coal in the past, he really sees things like solar power and wind energy as the technologies of the future. And he wants to be part of brokering the deals that make that possible.
Bellamy, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed.
That's KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe. The land in West Lewis County is more rolling hillside than steep climb. It is farmland in a lot of places, forest in others. Centralia and Chehalis sit at the confluence of the Chehalis and Skookumchuck Rivers, and that presents a risk, one that became all too real on December 3rd, 2007. People here woke up that Monday morning to massive flooding. I-5 was closed for days, as were the railroads, affecting commerce up and down the West Coast. But more importantly, people here lost everything. Homes, businesses, livestock, all swallowed up by water that came fast and without mercy. It has been more than a decade since that happened, but leaders are still dealing with the aftermath of the flood. They're trying to figure out how to be ready when the rivers flood again. Edna Fund is a Lewis County commissioner. She's on the Chehalis River Basin Flood Authority, and she met up with me between I-5 and the Chehalis River on what is now a big slab of concrete.
This was a slaughtering plant, and when we've had floods in the past, it has come onto this ground. So we took that structure down, so we have one less structure in the floodplain.
How long have you lived in this area?
I have lived in this area 52 years.
What does the Chehalis River mean to this region? What does it do for Lewis County?
What it does for us are multiple things. We have farmers, we have agriculture, so it means a lot when people are flooded out of their homes and their barns. We had cattle that were lost. We had sheep, goats. It was very, very tough on our farmers when it flooded.
Yeah.
You like the Chehalis River so you can irrigate, but when you lose all of your cattle, that's tough to swallow and try to come back from that. It's also a recreation area. People like to fish here. People like to swim. They love being near the river. We've got parks next to the river, Rainbow Falls. Very, very popular place. So it means a lot for us in terms of tourism. People like to come here.
I hear you describing something that is kind of both a lifeblood and a threat.
Yes, it is. It is a lifeblood and a threat.
Tell me about the 2007 flood and your experience of it. There were a lot of businesses and homes that were lost, and I imagine you knew many of those people personally.
I did. It took them a long time to get in. And shortly after that, I was running for city councilor, and I was doorbelling the south end of Centralia, and I came across houses that were empty. And there was one house, I'll never forget it. It had their picture window with Merry Christmas 2007. And
this is 2009 when you're doing
yes,
it.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. Those people left and had no home to come back to.
It's 11 years now since, almost 11 years mm-hmm. now since that has happened. Are you still feeling it? Is it something in the past, or is it something that's still kind of present?
It's present for me. Every time it rains really bad, I think, okay, is this another one? I get on the gauges. I look at, where are we compared to the previous times. It even brings tears to my eyes still, thinking about what we went through.
History would suggest that this will happen again.
Mm-hmm.
How do you prepare for that, and how do you make sure that even if you can't prevent it from happening again, you can at least try to mm-hmm. make sure that something like 2007, doesn't occur again?
Well, right now, the Chehalis Basin Flood Authority, we have projects throughout. We have farm pads, so those cows that I was talking about in the past that died, the farmer can bring them up to the farm pads, and they can also bring some of their machinery, because they lost a lot of their machinery at that time, too. We're looking at different ways in which we can help our county, as well as Grace Harbor and Thurston, by building a water retention facility. So we have the Lewis County Flood Zone District for the Chehalis River working on a dam, a water retention facility.
Public policy debates bring together a lot of strong opinions.
Oh, yes.
A lot of different options about what can happen or should not happen.
Yes.
Are you optimistic that you'll get to a place where you reach a decision where you say, this is the direction we're going?
I am more encouraged than I ever have been.
Why?
When I think about the opening days of the Flood Authority, no one could agree. It was just not a good situation. And name calling, it was just, just dredge the river, that'll solve it. Or just move everybody out of Centralia and Chehalis, and that'll solve it. But now we're at a place where we're all working together, and you need that in order to go to the legislature, to go to Congress, to ask for help.
Is there a lesson there for other people who are engaged in these big public policy
conversations? Yes. Trying to find things that you agree on first. Look at your similarities. Look at things that say, yes, I can put my thumbprint on that and say, yes, I agree. Versus, oh, I don't like that, I don't like that, that. But one thing at a time. It doesn't come overnight, that's for sure.
Edna Fund, Lewis County Commissioner, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for coming to Lewis County.
Edna says she hopes people remain vigilant about flooding, but she wants the memory of the flood to fade just enough so that it is not the first thing people associate with Lewis County. Let's climb high above the floodplain now. When you drive southeast into Centralia, you can't help but notice the backdrop of the Seminary Hill Natural Area. Its acres of protected forest are close at hand and open to all. KNKX producer Jeffrey Reddick takes us for a walk in the woods.
I want to introduce you to Judy Bell. To her, Seminary Hill isn't just a place to go for a walk. It's a sacred place.
It's like a cathedral.
And when Judy's on the trails in Seminary Hill, she gestures at the landscape and says things like this.
Look, isn't this gorgeous? Isn't this gorgeous?
She walks up to huge Douglas firs, throws her arms wide, and pats their trunks. She actually hugs trees.
I should have been doing environmental science in college instead of health. This is my love.
It's not easy to love a place. When you love a place for real, you do everything you can to keep it beautiful. She's not doing it alone. Judy's a member of the Friends of Seminary Hill. It's a group that was started way back in the early 1980s by two Girl Scout leaders. Back then, the Friends helped convince city leaders to protect the area from logging. And then they made it usable. They laid down railroad ties to make steps up the steep hillside, and they widened the trails. Now they sponsor community events, Earth Day projects, kids programs, geology walks, wildflower walks, poetry walks. And when Judy walks, she notices everything.
Cute little snowberry.
Yeah.
That's little. I mean, it's new. Hey, there's a new little sword friend coming in.
Yeah.
The other person you heard is Lisa Carlson. She teaches environmental sciences at Centralia College, and she considers Seminary Hill an outdoor classroom.
This place is close enough, and there are enough different loops in here that you could come here for a 10-minute walk, you could come here for a 4-hour hike.
I spent a couple hours with Judy and Lisa, and I learned that right now the biggest enemy of Seminary Hill is ivy.
When you come into a natural area, you want to see native plants. You don't want to see ivy.
In the areas they've cleared, native plants are thriving.
These ferns are huge.
Sword fern, we've got Oregon grape. That's called inside-out flower.
The ivy is still so close. I mean, does it feel threatening?
This project is never going to be done. No. There's always going to be ivy, and it's always going to take work to keep it at bay.
Along the trails and on the hills, we can remove the ivy. It won't take that much maintenance to keep up. And there's a little pieces of ivy growing, but not much.
Their timeline isn't annual. It's generational. And their work is a continuation of those who came before.
So we are on the Kaiser Ridge Trail now. And this was named for Rufus Kaiser, who was my predecessor's predecessor. He was definitely a big presence in the city. He was a big part of the Friends of Seminary Hill. But he continued his walks up here, well, into his, not just his final days, but his final day. Huh. He went for his walk one day, and he didn't come home, and he died in this place that he loved. So this trail's named in his honor.
Kaiser Trail leads you to Stabler Point, named for Stella Jo Stabler, one of the Girl Scout leaders who helped keep the hill from being clear-cut.
It's really pretty when there's a lot of fog and clouds or when it's fall and you can see color.
Until I, see the town again, you sort of forget it's there.
Until the train comes through.
But you know, when you're in the forest and the train is loud, it's company.
I don't mind the train unless I'm lecturing.
Yeah.
Then I just pause.
Yeah, it's company. It's part of Centralia.
Judy Bell and Lisa Carlson speaking with KNKX producer Jeffrey Reddick. They are members of the Friends of the Seminary Hill Natural Area. The nonprofit group has many members and a long history, and you can learn more about them on our website, knkx.org. Don't take your shoes off just yet. Jeffrey's going to take us for one more walk. Dimitri Matheny playing the horn there. The jazz musician lived in San Francisco for 20 years, but in 2015 he moved to Centralia, right between the emerald and the rose, as he says. He lives in town with his girlfriend Sassy and their dog Scout, and he showed us around the city's downtown. He says that as a musician, he travels a lot for work, and so he sees a lot of towns, but they don't feel like home. Not like Centralia.
And the first time I went to San Francisco, I had this feeling like, wow, I could live right there. I could rent an apartment right there, and that would be my dry cleaner, and I'd park my car there, you know. And I felt the same kind of feeling here, like this could be a home. I could live here. We're on Pearl Street. We're going to cross over to Tower and just walk along the main drag there in the historic downtown area. This is the old Lewis and Clark Hotel. I love the facade. This guy has everything, this old hardware store. It's remarkable. I've needed some little thing and gone in there just on a lark to see if he has it, and he'll go in the back and get it for you. It's kind of cool. And I like that, you know, there's all of this brick and cobblestone and these beautiful flowers. And I was talking to my friend Donnie, who came here from Philadelphia and opened a barbershop. And he was talking about, you know, that they're pretty good about coming around and getting you to sign up and support these local improvement projects. So here's our little diner, the Centerville Cafe. We would come down here and there'd be a table of like farmers and truckers and people that come down here and they every weekend and they're, you know, and I love to eavesdrop. I'll say to Sassy, when I get off the road and retire, I'm going to be one of these guys. I'm going to come down here and eat bacon and eggs and gossip.
Jazz musician and now Centralia resident Dimitri Matheny showing us around town. This is a KNKX News special report. I'm Ed Ronco. Tonight we're visiting the cities of Centralia and Chehalis.
3, 2, 1.
In mid-August, a crowd gathered in Centralia, in the rain, by the way, to unveil a statue depicting the city's founder, George Washington, along with his wife, Mary Jane, and their dog, Rockwood. Brian Mitke led the committee behind the statue and other celebrations, and he told our program's sound effect that this George Washington has an extraordinary background.
His mom was white, and his dad was a black slave. His dad was sold right after George was born, and his mom just faced this heartbreaking choice. She knew that her son would certainly face a life of slavery, and so she gave him to a white couple named James and Anna Cochran to raise as their own. They went west of the American frontier, and George was raised as a pioneer man. He learned how to shoot and you know, skin game and sew his own clothes. And they ended up going to Missouri, and he became a young businessman, but he faced real racial obstacles. There are laws that prevented him from operating his business as a free man. He told his family, his white foster family, in 1850, he said, "I'm going west. If there is a decent place in this world, I'm going to find it."
George Washington founded what was then called Centerville in 1875, and modern-day Centralia just finished a year-long celebration of his 200th birthday. During our live broadcast from Lewis County last week, I spoke with one of the Bicentennial Committee members, Heather Baird.
He was extremely religious, but he was a man that lived his religion. He didn't preach to other people. He just firmly held his beliefs and believed that every man was equal before God. So that included the people that didn't like him. That included people that actively worked against him. He helped them all.
Does his story resonate with you personally? And if so, how?
It does, because it. He was considered a black man entirely on what people saw when they first looked at him. But he was, in fact, mixed, as I am. And as many racial obstacles as he faced, he also was a beneficiary of white privilege. Many times, you know, he had two separate states that passed special laws for him to be allowed to be a citizen of that state with all the attendant rights and responsibilities, you know, which is fantastic for a black man. But both legislative documents mentioned that he was born of a white mother. And so it resonates in that, you know, it is sometimes you have that initial judgment based on outward appearance, but, you know, white privilege is unfortunately a thing. He was a beneficiary, as I am.
So we have George Washington who you know, establishes Centralia, gets it up and running. Here in Chehalis, one of the key founders of the city was a woman. Tell us a little bit about Eliza Barrett.
She was a firecracker. She was an illiterate Irish woman. Mm-hmm. She came over from Ireland to escape one of the potato famines, met her husband, Schuyler Saunders, and they founded Chehalis, and he died fairly young, and she took it over.
How has she been remembered by history?
She's not as prominent as George Washington. Mm-hmm. There are definitely people. Julie McDonald Zander has written some excellent books about her. Edna Fund, one of our county commissioners and a local historian, keeps Eliza's name alive. And my goal would be to get her gravestone spelled correctly.
Mm, it's spelled wrong.
It is. Her last name is Barrett, and it is spelled Barrett. Mm. But the bicentennial of her birth is coming up in 2024, and so...
So there's an opportunity.
There is.
As we wrap up here, you know, she wanted Chehalis to have a certain feeling.
Yeah, she referred to Chehalis as her village. You know, she put up an opera house and a church and a girls' Catholic school. She wasn't looking for big money to come in. In fact, Northern Pacific Railroad asked her to donate acreage for their tracks, and they said it would be a privilege to you. And she said no. And so the town boosters raised, you know, they got the depot here, and she still got her money for the land.
Has that feeling, the village feeling, withstood the years?
I think so.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful community. People take care of each other. I think that the village feel, you know, we've definitely got people and money and wonderful business here, but it still is ultimately a small town.
Well, we will keep our eyes on the future for the bicentennial of Eliza
yes,
Barrett.
2024.
All right. Heather Baird, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Heather Baird was on the George Washington Bicentennial Committee in Centralia. We're listening tonight to voices from Centralia and Chehalis. Let's hear another. Angela Mead is an opera singer, a soprano. She appeared in Frankfurt, Germany in June. Next month, she's in Spain. In November, it's New York for 7 performances at the Met, and she's coming to Seattle early next year to debut with the Seattle Opera. Mead grew up in Centralia, and she told me that she was set on the path to an opera career right here in Lewis County. Do you remember the first piece of opera music you ever heard?
Well, so the first opera I ever heard, and it's complete, was Così fan tutte at Tacoma Opera. So after I graduated from high school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I thought I might be a doctor. I was sort of interested in that kind of stuff, and I was good at it. So I was going to Centralia College, community college, you know, lots of math and science classes, and I was sort of hating it. I didn't really like the lab class. And so as my elective, I would go and take, like, music classes. I was singing in the choir, and I was taking, like, music theory, because I'm a nerd, apparently, as an elective. The same teacher taught the choir and all of the music classes, and so she also taught the music theory class. And she was like, you know, I know that you're a really good singer, and you have a beautiful voice, and I'd sung some solos with the choir. And she says, have you ever been interested in taking some voice lessons? I said, sure, I'll take some lessons. And she gave me the name of this guy, Wayne Bloomingdale, in Olympia, Washington, and I had no idea what I was doing. I went home and I learned them and I came back the next week. And he was like, these are really good. You know, you sound like an opera singer. And I was like, what does that mean? I went home and sort of started researching. I would go down to the public library there in Centralia and I would take out books like weekly and read about them, and I would go into like the DVD and CD section, which was also small, and take out CDs and listen to them.
Angela Mead told her parents that she wanted to be a music major. She enrolled at Pacific Lutheran University, and after she graduated,
I decided that I wanted to move to New York, come hell or high water. So I auditioned for the Manhattan School of Music and some other places, and I got into Manhattan School of Music and moved there 2 weeks before 9/11.
We'll be watching this for much of the day. There is chaos in New York at the moment. There have been not one, but two incidents.
There's thousands of people who are in New York looking for relatives.
So I was traumatized and moved back home for a year.
But New York wasn't gone for good, just on hold. An instructor from a young artists program she participated in was teaching at the University of Southern California, and he invited her to audition for their graduate school. So she did, and she started her master's and doctorate degrees there. Then she got into the Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia, which exclusively works with opera singers. And in 2008, Angela Mead made her professional debut at New York's Metropolitan Opera, the Met, singing the role of Elvira in the Verdi opera Hernani.
Hernani, Hernani,
they told me about 24 hours before I went on that I would be stepping in. So I had to make all those arrangements for my parents to come out and called friends and all that stuff.
You probably don't have a lot of time to sit back and say and kind of let the moment wash over you. You have things to do out there.
Correct. Not until after it was over did all of those, you know, good warm feelings sort of take hold. Before that, it was just, I have to do my job.
You know, on stage, you sing for thousands of people at a time, and mm-hmm. you do these complicated and demanding pieces of music. What do you sing around the house?
High notes and coloratura.
Which singers or which operas do you love watching purely as an audience member?
You know, I don't go a tremendous amount. Isn't that terrible?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't listen to news radio after I get off work, you know?
That's true. I think people, though, expect that I, like, live in the theater constantly. I actually like watching the things that I do. Mm. I like to go and watch other people sing the rep that I do to get different perspective.
Yeah. Is it possible to be a purely an audience member after a career?
No.
Yeah.
I don't think it is. My husband and I talk about this all the time because...
Your husband is also an opera singer.
He is.
a tenor, John Matthew Myers.
Correct. He's much more passive in his watching than I am. And I'm like, you know, we joke and say I'm the sidewalk police because I'm always like, okay. It's hard for me to just sit and enjoy.
Yeah, you like get in the car and go through your notes? Is it?
Yeah, basically.
How did growing up in Centralia shape you? Who did it make you into?
I mean, I don't know if people are different based on where they grew up. Mm. I think, you know, your family probably shapes that more than anything. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that it would matter if I'd have grown up in Los Angeles versus Centralia. I mean, I think I'm down to earth, maybe. I mean, more down to earth. Like, I know the value of working, and I mean, I don't know, but I don't think that has to do with, everybody's always like, oh, how can you be an opera singer from Centralia? I'm like, well, the people who sing opera have got to be from somewhere. They weren't all raised in Lincoln Center, right? So I don't know, but I get that a lot. People are like, well, how could you possibly be a singer? You're from Centralia, Washington. Well,
that question can feel so condescending, I think, you know?
I mean, I don't think people think it's condescending. They just equate it with themselves, and they think, well, how could I possibly be from a small town? Everybody who's famous has come from, like, a big city. Well, that's not true.
It's quite the path. I mean, what, do you think about the road not taken? I mean, Dr. Mead singing arias in her off? No.
No.
No looking back. This is it.
Yep.
Angela Mead, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Angela Mead did not become a medical doctor, as she originally thought, but through her career in opera, she has been a duchess, the daughter of Helen of Troy, a druid high priestess, the Queen of England, and so much more. On average, some 50 to 60 trains a day pass through Centralia and Chehalis. They are largely freight trains, though Amtrak also runs routes through this corridor. But every so often, if you know the right place to look, you might find a century-old steam train chugging along the tracks. The Chehalis-Centralia Railroad and Museum offers rides on the weekends here, as it has done for nearly 30 years. I dropped by the depot in Chehalis earlier this month, right as the dinner train was about to leave, to talk to one of the volunteers who's been working on trains for most of his life. On the day we visit, the steam locomotive is out of commission, busted spring, as it turns out. And because it's a 100-year-old steam locomotive, you can't just run to the store. You have to send away for help to Salem, Oregon. So after the dinner train leaves, pulled by a diesel engine tonight, I meet Harold Borovic.
What radio station are you with?
I am with KNKX Public Radio.
Never heard of it.
Yeah.
Borovic is wearing a bluish-green work shirt and matching pants. They are the kind of dirty you can only get around heavy equipment, like locomotives. He's also wearing a red engineer's cap with white polka dots, a gift from his son several Father's Days ago. We sit down.
If you don't think it's rude, may I ask how old you are?
Now?
Yes.
Well, let's see. April, I was 91.
91. And you still hop into a cab sometimes and drive a locomotive.
I can. I have the ability. Tell you the truth, I think I'm the best engineer here, but they don't believe that. But I do. Anyway, there's a knack to being a good engineer. You don't run into stuff with a slam bang. You're careful and you do it so that when you couple into another car, it just goes click and you're there. And
sounds like there's some finesse involved.
Yeah.
You first worked on a railroad when you were 16 years old.
Yeah. I actually got out of school an hour early, and I worked 2 hours for the railroad. And this went on 6 days a week.
So you're 16 years old. You're working on the rails. What is your duty? What do you have to do every day?
All I did was I kept a record of where all the cars were each day. I would make an inventory. It's called yard checking.
All right, you said all he did was yard checking, but that's not entirely true. When he was a young man, no longer a teenager, but still not an engineer, a favorite uncle who worked the graveyard shift for the railroad would let Harold run small locomotives up and down the tracks.
I'd get on and he'd say, "You want to check her for a while?" "Sure." So he'd sit down and he'd be right next to me. So I'd run them things till they went to lunch.
Trains have always been Harold Borovic's passion, if not his paycheck. He did other jobs throughout his adulthood, but always found a way to keep trains in his life. He's been volunteering on the Chehalis steam train since its restoration in the 1980s, and he remembers in exacting detail how important the rails were to the products that were made in this region, whether it was shipments of vinegar from a factory in Pierce County or timber from nearby logging camps.
They shaped the whole Lewis County area.
That is Ted Livermore.
The rails were built here to start transporting the timber out, the agricultural products, because it was a big fruit and vegetable processing area.
Livermore is helping the Lewis County Historical Museum write a history of the railroads around Chehalis from its earliest days in the 1870s to the construction of the iconic train stations in the 19-teens, to today. And he's loved trains since he was 3 years old. The big ones that blow through town and the little ones that you can hold in the palm of your hand. He is the president of the Lewis County Model Railroad Club. We're staring at an enormous model railroad that fills up an entire room here at the Historical Museum.
It's actually 17 feet deep and it's 54 feet long.
Okay.
The detail here is incredible. Inside a miniature lumber mill, a tiny little worker is frozen in the middle of sawing a tiny little log on a tiny little buzzsaw. I mean, this log is maybe as big as a house key, maybe. Buildings from around Lewis County are custom made for this model. There are people who live around here who could conceivably look at this and see their house or the store they shopped at yesterday. The meticulous detail is one way model railroaders show their appreciation for the full-scale version, the railroads and trains that have shaped this county's economy and life for more than a century, and that Livermore says will continue to be important into the future.
When you look at the size of the rail cars they have now, and imagine how many trucks it would take to haul what's in just one box car, one grain car, one tank car, you're talking of thousands of more trucks on the road.
And we called BNSF, by the way, the rail line that owns the tracks running through here. Spokesman Gus Malonis says an average train can carry as much as 280 to 300 truckloads of freight. You're listening to 88.5 KNKX. Tonight, KNKX connects to Centralia and Chehalis. I'm Ed Ronco. Many schools around the country are putting a lot of emphasis on STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. WF West High School in Chehalis is no exception. They opened a new STEM wing at the beginning of the year. Over the summer, about 40 students participated in a science camp that connected them with actual scientists. First, researchers from the University of Washington's Institute for Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine came to Chehalis to meet the students on their home turf. A few days later, the students traveled to Seattle for a tour of the labs. Charles Murray is the director of the institute. He says it was the first time they've worked with high school students, and his researchers were eager to volunteer their time.
Because everybody remembers what it was like to be in high school and to be sort of a geeky science-oriented kid, and then the impact that a few events along the way made in your professional trajectory. Somebody who said the right thing at the right time that kind of planted a seed that grew. When I was a senior in high school, I was taking advanced biology, and I got super lucky because I got connected with a general surgeon. And so this guy let me come and scrub in on surgical cases. So I was actually gloved and gowned and things like that. And it was completely eye-opening, awesome, and inspiring for me. I can't pay Dr. Goffner back. So what you do is you pay this forward. You pass the torch to the next generation. And so that's some of what we were trying to do.
Jeannot Mooster is one of those torch passers. He showed the students thousands of transparent fish whose internal organs glow. Mooster is researching heart regeneration. The fish he works with can lose up to a third of their hearts and regrow the missing portion. He wants to know why people can't do that.
We have the same genes that are responsible for that regeneration, but in us, it's turned off. I think it is the most awesome stuff to watch animals like this grow, because the best part about these things is they're completely transparent, so I can watch everything growing in them, all their guts and stuff forming and becoming intestine or kidneys or brains and stuff like heart.
Wendy Neal teaches chemistry and molecular biology at WF West High School. She says the experience of hosting the researchers was instructive for her.
I definitely saw some ways that they were teaching the kids that were more hands-on, and like the concepts are extremely difficult because it's micro, like you can't see it, and they had a lot of good ideas that engaged the students. And then what I could take them to is the next level. It's the lab part. To have that opportunity and just to interact with real live scientists was pretty amazing. And then to come up here and see those same people in their labs, like, oh, this is how it works. Because I don't think they have that concept of, you know, what do I do after high school and what are the options besides what I can immediately see around me.
For Charles Murray, the director of the Stem Cell Institute, the hope for this kind of outreach is not only to enrich the educational opportunities of the students, it's to groom the next generation of researchers who will work toward his ultimate goal.
The big dream really is to make Seattle the birthplace of regenerative medicine, where we really put stem cells to work to grow back people's body parts.
That's Charles Murray, the director of the University of Washington's Institute for Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine. Now, let's turn our attention to a group of people who probably make heavy use of modern medicine. When you think of roller derby, you're probably going to picture two teams of women dressed up in crazy outfits, wild hair flowing out the bottom of a helmet, and hitting, a lot of hitting. But the players, who are part of Centralia's Rainy City Roller Dolls, see the sport a little differently. It is an outlet for them, for a group of misfits to cobble together their own family. KNKX producer Ariel Van Cleve has that story.
The team practices three times a week in the Centralia Roller Dome. And the skating rink is exactly what you'd hope it would look like, with green and pink neon light tubes. There's a disco ball hanging from the ceiling prominently in the middle of the rink. It's also a very quiet place on a Sunday morning when I join the team for its usual run-throughs of exercise and drills. Only about half the members showed up for this one, but that isn't stopping them. That's Connie Gardner's voice. She's better known in the derby world as Contagious. She's also one of the leaders of this group of skaters. Gardner's been in four different derby leagues and came to the game from a slightly different path than maybe a typical sporty type would. She just wanted to make friends.
I've never played a sport. I've never been physical. I've never felt the urge to work out. I've never done any of that. I was bored. I was like, hey, I should check out this roller derby thing.
Going from non-athlete to, as she calls herself, an okay skater, hasn't necessarily been an easy transition, but it's been worth it.
I genuinely love these people to death, and so I just keep coming back because there's no reason not to.
Gardner says the Rainy City Roller Dolls give her a familial feel, and out of all the groups she's played with, she's been the most comfortable with this team of skaters.
We want to help each other and build each other up and work with each other and just enjoy each other and their company, and so it doesn't matter whether this is your first season or your 10th season, right? We're all in it together, and we're only as good as each other.
That's a big part of derby, supporting your fellow teammate when you see they're struggling with learning the rules of the game or even how to skate. A lot of roller derby players, just like Gardner, come to the game without much experience of actually being on a team. And that could be for a few reasons. Concerned about not being athletic enough, maybe the cost to play is going to be too high. For others, as Gardner explains, players might not have felt comfortable with other teams.
We are, I think, the only sport that is so gender inclusive, which is incredible and something I truly love. We have folks that are non-binary. We have folks that identify as queer. We have folks that identify as straight. We have folks that don't identify, you know.
Two of the seven players at practice the day I'm there identify with he, him, they, them pronouns. Tay Hopkins, or NB Demick, says for him, playing with the team means more than just getting a little exercise.
I obviously need like a place that's safe for me and no one's going to give me a hard time in regard to gender stuff, because it's just like at the end of the day I just want to play a sport and not have to deal with like any kind of issues or anything like that.
In fact, derby is Hopkins' first ever team sport, thanks in large part to the rules around who gets to play. The Women's Flat Track Derby Association, which governs teams like Rainy City, adopted a gender policy 7 years ago focused on making the sport more inclusive. And now, even the team has talked about revising its own name to replace or completely drop the Dolls from the title. Hopkins says he isn't surprised to see these changes happen.
Because originally with, like, roller derby, it's kind of, like, tied into, like, the punk rock feminist sort of movement. So I feel like roller derby kind of caters to, like, the marginalized group of people.
It also caters to people looking for an outlet. In Hopkins' case, he wanted to get out of the house more and find ways to cope with his mental health. For Ivana Papatart, a.k.a. Becky Parvin, it was a way to spend her time after her kids left the house. She says each of the players is searching for something, whether it's getting out your aggression, staying active, or finding new friends. Parvin has dedicated herself to the sport after trying it out on a whim a few years ago in Tacoma, and it's made her feel empowered, even on her worst days.
Over the years, you know, there's always the self-doubt that comes in. Oh, I didn't have a good practice. I didn't do that well. But I am strong. And the most important thing is I'm not sitting on my couch. I'm out. I'm enjoying myself. I mean, these people are just, I mean, no matter where my story ends, you know, years from now or next year, because the team changes so much because life happens and people go. And but these people here will always be a part of me, always.
That camaraderie is what Parvin says sets roller derby apart. And it may have something to do with it being such a high contact sport.
In other sports, I feel like you still have your personal bubble. I mean, yeah, there's a tiny bit of contact, but when you start like contacting each other, like literally, you know, your shoulders are making contact, your hips are making contact, you don't have a bubble. In society, those bubbles are what protect you. And so when you start tearing down those bubbles, it just kind of automatically, I think, just lets people in.
The act of letting people in isn't an easy thing for anybody. But players on this team have found that taking a risk, both physical and mental, can pay off. And that's made it possible to create a community for themselves. Ariel Van Cleve, KNKX News.
The Rainy City Roller Dolls host their 11th annual Knocktoberfest next month. It is a four-team mini-tournament, and it happens on October 6th at the Centralia Roller Drome. There's a lot going on in these communities as summer turns to fall. Centralia High School and WF West High School both had their first football games of the season this past Friday, not against each other. That rivalry game comes later. Football just doesn't seem right without a band, in our opinion. So we dropped by the first full rehearsal of the season for the Bearcat Pep Band at WF West High School in Chehalis.
If you haven't already, let's start getting our instruments out and start marking up upperclassmen.
My name is Adam Campagna, and I am the band director at WF West High School in Chehalis, Washington. You are listening to the Bearcat Pep Band, and we perform primarily at our home football games, at our basketball games. We perform at school assemblies, around the community, at different events. I've done assignments in the past where I've had my students go through their day and chart every time music was in their life. From their ringtone to the commercials, our football team listens to music every practice. So music is around us everywhere.
Hi, I'm Luke Amrine. I'm a junior at WF West High School.
Hi, my name is Gage Camp. I'm a senior.
The responsibilities of being a drum major is just kind of being the positive force of the band and keeping everyone energetic.
I think for me, it's leading by example and showing everybody what band can be. To me, band is family. I think music brings people together.
My name is David March, and I play bass drum 2 in the drum line. The harness for the bass drum alone doesn't hurt, but with the bass drum, it hurts your shoulders a lot. My father is a percussionist, so it's sort of following in his footsteps.
My name is Tasha Duggar. I'm going to be a sophomore, and I play the clarinet and the bass clarinet. I started in Napavine, so it was like either you went to band or you did homework during that period that everybody else did it. So I was like, I guess I'll try band. Honestly, I feel like bands kind of like helped me open up a little bit. I like transferred from Napavine to Chehalis when I was a freshman, so it was like I didn't really know anybody, but with the whole band camp, it helped with that because I ended up having a lot of people from band in my classes, so like that helped get used to Chehalis.
The WF West High School Bearcat Pep Band at their first rehearsal last week. That's it for us tonight. Special thanks to everyone in Centralia and Chehalis who gave us time and shared their stories. Our news director is Aaron Hennessy. Matt Martinez is our director of content. Our engineers are Lowell Kiso, Nick Winter, and we get IT support from Tad Doviak. Brenda Goldstein-Young is our director of community outreach and events. She's aided by Adrian Flores. We had stories from Bellamy Palethorpe, Ashley Gross, and Ariel Van Cleve as part of our KNKX Connects reporting. And this program is produced by Jeffrey Reddick. You can find a lot of our stories from Centralia and Chehalis on our website, knkx.org, and we will be doing more of these programs in the months ahead from across our listening area. I'm Ed Ronco. This is 88.5 KNKX.